Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Hello, folks. It's Jim Hansen with the Center for Security Policy, and we are doing some Secure Freedom Radio. I'm sitting in for Mr. Frank Gaffney, who is out keeping the world safe for democracy, and I have the pleasure of being joined by another member of the Center for Security Policy, Claire Lopez, who was basically the lead on our project to write an actual strategy to confront our enemy, the one the president won't name, the one that randomly kills people, the one that is unaffiliated. We're talking about the global jihad movement. Welcome to the show, Claire.
Hi, Jim. Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Well, first I'd like to ask, the president has sent up to Congress at least a draft of an AUMF, and it's a pretty remarkable document in that it might be the first time an executive, a commander-in-chief, you know, the leader, has asked a co-equal branch of government to limit his power and his ability to fight. What were your impressions of his authorization to use military force?
Yeah, you're exactly right, Jim. This new draft of an AUMF not only limits the president's power, which would be his plus successors, actually, for 3 years, this being 2015, it would go, you know, for 3 years into the next presidency, but it also limits it in terms of geography and names only Iraq and Syria. Of course, those originally artificially constructed countries don't really exist anymore even, but to the extent that they do, that is the place where the Islamic State is with most of its operations right now, but it's certainly not the only place. But that limits it to Iraq and Syria. The AUMF also limits it to no ground troops, and they want to avoid something called offensive enduring operations, whatever that is.
Well, it would be offensive to the guys they were killing, I think, if there were ground troops there, right?
Well, I suppose so. The things that it does authorize are rescue operations. I guess that would mean especially for downed pilots, the use of special operations forces to go after top Islamic State leadership, and then intelligence collection and assistance to partner forces. Hopefully that would include the Kurds.
Okay, so that's kind of interesting. Now, I can understand not wanting to get embroiled in another ground war in the same place where we spent a lot of time, blood of a lot of our folks, you know, and a lot of money to no effect. It might have worked if Obama hadn't cut and run, but we'll never know because he did. But why in the world would he go ahead and tell them to limit him? Is it more about his successor? I don't think he wants to do anything. I think that's been proven. But is he actually trying to limit, you know, the ability of anyone following him?
Well, I'm going to play a little bit of devil's advocate here and actually take the side of our president for a moment and in a way. I look at this struggle going on right now in the Middle East as the most recent iteration of a 1,300-year-plus battle between Shiites and Sunnis. In other words, this is intra-Islamic, it is sectarian struggle. The Islamic State most directly threatens and now occupies territory that belongs to Iran, belongs to Iranian puppets in any case, the Baghdad one and the Damascus one. Now, as it's throwing off offshoots and tentacles and franchises, if you will, in other places, that is something that the AUMF doesn't even address. You know, and you mentioned our Secure Freedom strategy that the Center for Security Policy published just a couple of weeks ago. And if we're going to take the perspective that we need to fight the global Islamic Jihad as an entity that is global, truly everywhere, then that's one thing. But to simply enter a Shiite-Sunni fray on the side of one of them, when they're both jihadists and they both hate us and they both see us and Israel destroyed if they could, seems to me to make no sense.
And that's a fair point. I mean, as a purely pragmatic U.S. interests only perspective, you're absolutely right. We don't have a dog in that fight. We are against all of them, or more accurately, they're all against us. So I think that's perfectly fair. Now, we're here with Claire Lopez. Claire headed the Tiger team that wrote the Center for Security Policy's Secure Freedom Strategy. In that, Claire, we have an actual draft declaration of war not just an authorization to use military force, and even less so, not just an authorization to use military force against one small piece of the global jihad. So tell us a little bit about what is contemplated in that document as an actual strategy to take on our enemy, both the violent jihadists and the nonviolent ones, everywhere they pop their heads up.
Yeah, well, exactly. You know, thanks to the wonderful team that came together, including yourself, to put that document together, I think that we've addressed the entirety of the threat that's facing us. And as you mentioned before, it's the global jihad movement. And that movement includes both violently offensive, kinetic terrorist organizations like Al-Qaeda, the Islamic State, Hamas, Hezbollah, Taliban, and so forth, Boko Haram for sure, Ansar al-Sharia in Libya, all of them. But it also takes into recognition that those are simply the tip of the spear, the vanguard of the Islamic movement, the jihad movement. And what sits behind them, lies behind them, and provides the inspiration and the impulse for them to act is the ideology of Islam, which is called Sharia. And that ideology is promulgated in different ways that are not all violent. And as we see right here in the United States and elsewhere in the West, particularly Canada and Western Europe, the Muslim Brotherhood, which is not violent in these places of the West, has the lead for advancing Sharia in our societies, but in stealthy ways, under the radar, if you will, the pre-violent stage of dawah. Dawah always is paired with and precedes jihad. For now, it's dawah, and it is infiltration, it is subordination, it is subversion of our national foundational principles and those of Western civilization. So our secure freedom strategy really addresses all of that, understanding that it is a whole package. It's not just this organization that today calls itself Islamic State. Yesterday it was ISIS. Day before that it was Islamic State in Iraq, Al-Qaeda in Iraq. No, it's not any particular group. It is the entirety of the global jihad movement that we need to address, confront, and defeat.
And obviously that makes perfect sense to me. The problem is that makes absolutely no sense to the folks spewing nonsense in our State Department and obviously our president himself, who hosted a Countering Violent Extremism summit last week, where some of the very folks you just talked about, the nonviolent ones, didn't even have to use stealth. They were invited into the process as the representatives who somehow are supposed to help us stop the terrorists. Do we have a prayer as long as our government believes that our enemy is going to help us defeat them?
And we're in trouble. I mean, no two ways about that, Jim, absolutely. Unless we can address the infiltration of our society and government and national security that's already taken place over a period of decades, let's remind ourselves, it didn't just happen under President Barack Obama. This began decades ago after World War II and has been proceeding ever since, much of it under the radar, the infiltration of the Muslim Brotherhood into positions of power and influence. And that includes not just our government, but academia and media and society as a whole. And unless we address that, not calling the Muslim Brotherhood terrorists, because that's not going to do it. They're not terrorists in this country. They are subversives. They are infiltrators and masterful operators of influence operations. Until we recognize that and address that and confront that and pull that out of our society and government, especially at the top levels of national security, we are going to be in a bad way. Basically, we are being neutered from the inside without violence. Our defenses are being destroyed from the inside by this influence, which doesn't even need to move to violence because they've had such success in promoting Sharia, the ideology of Sharia, from the inside of our system.
Well, Claire, obviously that clarion call needs to be heeded. And fortunately, as we've discussed, we do have a strategy. It does have a plan, and we're taking that plan to Congress. We'll be giving the Secure Freedom Strategy 100 pages of pretty good ideas to all the members of Congress, the requisite committees, and the other folks here inside the Beltway, as well as you. You can download the strategy from our securefreedom.org website and read it yourself and tell your congresspeople to pay attention. This is a fight we need to win. It's a fight for the free world. And unlike the president, we have a plan. Let's hope Congress takes it up. Thanks very much, Claire. It's been a pleasure hearing the details of this. And I wish you and us good luck.
Thank you.
Next up, we will be talking with Adam Credo of the Washington Free Beacon. This is Jim Hansen sitting in for Frank Gaffney doing Secure Freedom Radio.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the Center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved, and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
This is Frank Gaffney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Jim Hansen sitting in for Frank Gaffney. I get the pleasure of being joined this segment by Adam Credo, writer for the Washington Free Beacon. And I wanted to talk with you, Adam, about this interesting piece you had about who actually was attending the Countering Violent Extremism Summit hosted by our president, vice president, and the rest of his staff. Some pretty interesting people you might not have expected, or we might have expected, but some folks might not have, actually attended. Can you tell us about this lovely gentleman from the Muslim Public Affairs Council?
Sure, yes, of course, I'd be happy to. So this individual you mentioned from the Muslim Public Affairs Council, that's a U.S. Muslim organization. He's the founder of it and still does work there. His name's Salem Al-Mariati. And he is quite an interesting and controversial person. One of his most notable comments came in the wake of the September 2001 attacks, literally right after they had occurred. It was during a radio interview and said that Israel should be on the suspect list for the 9/11 attacks. Now, even at that point in time, it was clear who was responsible for this, Islamic terrorists, Saudi individuals, but yet he took the opportunity to cast a light on Israel. That's not the only controversial thing about him, however. Several other comments he's made throughout the years, highly critical of Israel. His organization, MPAC, has accused Israel of blood libels, orchestrating the organs of Palestinian people. So I think quite controversial, and somebody you might not necessarily want to put on a docket with Joe Biden at the White House for your Countering Violent Extremism Summit.
Well, I want to continue down this path of this extremely useful exercise the president and his minions did to go ahead and fail to name our enemy or come up with a useful strategy. This is Jim Hansen sitting in for Frank Gaffney doing Secure Freedom Radio, talking with Adam Credo of the Washington Free Beacon, and we're discussing the Countering Violent Extremism Summit. Now, Adam, we talked about this Salem Al-Mariati, who is basically a classic anti-Semite type running the Muslim Public Affairs Council. But he wasn't the only one. There were basically a bunch of folks who operate as front groups for what I would call the stealth jihad. And basically, they're the guys trying to advance an agenda that allows some of the things that none of us really want happening in this country, that, you know, Sharia law, some of the cheesier things about the Islamic states. And they were invited in and made the lead participants. If these are the guys we're dealing with, do we have any chance of actually expecting any moderate Muslims to have any power to help us in this fight?
Well, one, no, I don't think so. And I think you make a very critical point there. And there is a larger piece of this. You're right. We can focus on one individual who was there, but the larger guest list and the whole idea of this needs to be discussed just from the 30,000 feet view. Countering Violent Extremism, the name itself, is problematic because it does not name the threat that we're actually facing, which is Islamic terrorism, Islamic extremism all across the world. So you're already starting from a position of weakness, a position of not naming the threat. Number two is the individuals you have attend, people who would rather pass laws on, say, free speech to outlaw things like the Muhammad cartoons and other examples of free speech and Western values that we've seen. These are people that blame people like those cartoonists rather than blaming the radical extremists that are trying to kill Westerners and destroy Israel and kill Jews.
Okay, so that is the point I think that people are missing. We are not actually countering violent extremism. What we're doing is putting a smiley, happy face on the partners of the violent extremists who are nonviolent extremists. They're just as extreme. They just use lawfare and lobbying and other things like this to influence their way into destroying us from within, using our own freedoms against us. Now, I want to ask another thing. The actual violent extremism, as you mentioned it, is a bad name for this. And I thought it was somewhat comical that just this week, a DHS, a Department of Homeland Security report came out noting that there are right-wing extremists in the United States who are more dangerous than the Islamic State. And I'd also just like to note they got my address wrong when they put that thing out. But I find that comical. They're doing everything they can to obfuscate the fact that we know who our enemy is, but we've got Obama talking about the Crusades, we've got Marie Harf telling people that we need to get them jobs, and we've got DHS claiming that right-wing extremists are more dangerous. We're kind of screwed, aren't we?
Well, you hit it right on the head there. I mean, look at what the issue is. The issue is that we have a White House that refuses to clearly identify the problem that we face and would rather bend itself backwards, twist itself like a pretzel. And you've seen the White House spokesman do this, and you're right, you've seen the State Department do this, trying to tell us that Muslim extremism, Islamic radicals are not actually the problem. They're all part of the same thing, which is these Christian militias and extremists. And I've even seen Jewish extremists named in State Department reports as problem areas. So, yeah, it tries to put everything on a level playing field when in reality, that's not the world that we face.
Well, now, you also wrote another piece. There have been anti-Semitic, pro-Islamic State graffiti in Washington, D.C., in our nation's capital. Do we have any idea who it is? Or even if we don't know who it is, isn't it a pretty bad sign no matter what?
It's a disturbing sign, and I think it speaks volumes to what's taking place in the rest of the world of violence towards Jews, the rise of anti-Semitism across the world, and even here in our own backyard. This graffiti has been popping up for months since late last year in a wealthy, affluent neighborhood of D.C., the DuPont Circle area that I think everybody knows well. And it's very bizarre. There are swastikas, there are Jewish stars with Allahu Akbar written underneath in Arabic, and it's unclear what exactly these people are trying to communicate, but I think the persistence of it is something very disturbing. And I'll note that a lot of it seemed to coincide with threats that were made to a Jewish-owned business in D.C. The business owner said he was being harassed by people who claimed to be affiliated with ISIS.
And that's part of the problem. Just this week, again, we have al-Shabaab and the Islamic State calling for lone wolf or known wolf attacks in the United States. They want somebody to hit the Mall of America. And the Mall of America is in Minnesota, in Minneapolis, where there is a very large Somali Muslim population who have been very active in sending their kids off to join the jihad, the global jihad. So, I mean, now we've got the graffiti's one thing. A threat of an attack on malls in the United States is terrifying. And yet we've got the White House doing nothing. Is there any hope? Are they going to do anything?
Well, look, I think that our law enforcement still actually does work properly as hard as it can. Nobody wants to see an attack like this. The White House is consumed with politics and consumed with narratives and this type of thing. But I do have faith in local law enforcement and their ability to at least try to prevent something like this. But look, absolutely right when it comes down to it. We have people that want to attack us. Al-Qaeda has continued to promote lone wolf attacks, and that's what they'd rather see. It's not going to be organized when it happens. It's much easier to have an individual carry these things out, just as we've seen in Europe with a lot of these people who are motivated by radicalism but are actually acting on their own behalf.
Well, unfortunately, I think that's the easy answer. They don't have to coordinate it. They just have to inspire it. And it's the Al-Qaeda franchise system. Now, we've got Bibi Netanyahu coming to town. That ought to be entertaining, right?
We do, coinciding with the AIPAC conference, the annual pro-Israel affair that takes place for several days. You know, Bibi's speech has caused quite a controversy among people. The White House fighting to, you know, make sure he doesn't give the speech. And, you know, it's interesting. I saw an article last week from the Associated Press. The White House is already laying the groundwork. They have a strategy in place. They're putting time and resources into combating Netanyahu. They want to have people out there to give speeches. The president himself is going to give an interview to a prominent reporter who covers Israeli politics.
Well, there you have it. Thanks, Adam. I'm glad you keep an eye on this. This is Jim Hansen sitting in for Frank Gaffney, and we'll be right back with more Secure Freedom Radio.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. This week, legislators will demonstrate whether they are going to fulfill their oath of office to support and defend the Constitution, or whether they will be complicit in Barack Obama's serial violations of his. The test will come as Senate Democrats hold hostage funding for the Department of Homeland Security unless Republicans allow the president to continue to amend or eviscerate immigration laws without congressional assent. Hats off to House Republicans who have refused to compromise the constitutional principle that only Congress can make law. Their Senate counterparts are to be congratulated for, to date, not folding either. If our republic is to survive the next 2 years of Team Obama's trashing the Constitution, Congress must hold the line. The DHS funding bill is the place to start. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts, now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word, answer. That's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. No matter what happens, if it matters to you and you listen long enough, you'll learn what it means and different ways to think about it. That's why we're here. Do this better than any station in town. Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
Navigating this world when you are undereducated can be difficult. I'm Dr. Ben Carson, and I know this for a fact. When I was growing up, my family lived in dire poverty, and because of my poor learning skills, my classmates called me dummy. My life began to turn around when my mother encouraged me to read. I went from the bottom of my class to graduating from Yale University and becoming the youngest director of pediatric neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins Hospital. I know how important it is to nurture a child's dream.
When I grow up, I want to become a scientist.
I want to be a doctor, just like Ben Carson.
I hope to become an engineer.
I want to be a teacher or maybe a broadcaster.
The Carson Scholars Fund is impacting schools across the nation by encouraging children to read, write, and excel at math and science so they can realize their dreams. We need your help. To learn more about the Carson Scholars Fund and to donate, visit our website at carsonscholars.org.
After all, the person who has the most to do with your success is you.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Jim Hansen sitting in for Frank Gaffney, and we're joined this segment by Jamie Detmer, who is a Mideast and Ukraine correspondent for the Daily Beast, as well as a roving broadcaster for Voice of America. Welcome to the show, Jamie.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, I wanted to ask you, you wrote a little bit about our good friend and ally, Qatar. I'm pretty sure they served as the bag man for the cash that went to the Taliban in return for Bo Bergdahl's release. And they do a lot of things for the United States that don't always make the papers. So can you tell us a little bit about this? They have a grand mosque that seems to be probably not doing us any favors in what they're preaching there.
No, sure. I mean, there's always been this very odd relationship between the U.S. and Gulf allies like Qatar, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia. Qatar recently has, you know, continued to, I suppose, the best way of putting it, would be to run with the hare and hunt with the hounds. As you know, it's a small, super wealthy emirate, kind of vulnerable. It doesn't always get on with its neighbors in the Gulf like Saudi Arabia. And it seems in many ways over the last, you know, past few years to be trying to increase its influence and please as many people as possible. But undercutting all of that is it's also a state that's based on the Wahhabi strain of Islam. They are 2,500 princes, for example, in
Qatar, many of whom hold rather extreme views. And the Grand Mosque in Doha, which we were looking at, is state-controlled.
Not an independent mosque. And they do have some very strange preachers there, calling for, you know, amongst other things, like one did the weekend before the burning of the Jordanian pilot, for the death of Jews, Christians, Shia Muslims, basically anyone of any faith who's not from Islam. The preacher was a Saudi preacher. He's been invited six times since 2013. He's not the only very fiery pro-jihadist preacher who appears at the Grand Mosque. There's a long list of them. And this, of course, causes ructions. I mean, the US government, as well as Western powers, have had great difficulty in trying to persuade Qatar, one, to kind of cut out this rather extreme Wahhabi preaching that's going on, and this mosque is a stopover for militants who are going through Qatar onwards to Iraq or Syria or Afghanistan, but also to stop the private donations that are coming from some very wealthy Qataris, including royal princes, which are going to jihadist organizations. Now, we all know that the Islamic State is almost virtually self-funding now, but it still does get some private donations from wealthy Gulf families, including from Qatar. And, of course, the Al-Qaeda group is very reliant on funding. There's been a tremendous amount of pressure by the U.S. government in the last few years to really get the Qataris to cut down on this, to little avail, actually. So we're in this very odd position. We rely on the Qataris. I agree with you. I think that they have acted as intermediaries in some hostage releases recently. We rely on the Qataris also for the largest U.S. Air Force base in the Gulf. Most of the strikes on the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq are flying from a U.S. base in Qatar. But we have this very, very odd relationship between us, and it's not always to our benefit.
Well, you gotta dance with the devil somewhat, and we don't really have any we have one ally in the Middle East, and Obama has done his best to torpedo that relationship with Israel. So let's talk about Qatar for a little longer. Their emir is coming to sit down and chat with him. Do you have any ideas on what may come of that? Do we have a chance to potentially get them in the fight with us more than just allowing us to operate from their territory?
I mean, I suspect from U.S. officials I've spoken to, there will be pressure on this terrorism funding. It's something that the Obama administration has been banging on about for a long time, and increasingly publicly. I think that there'll be this kind of double game of thanking the Qataris for joining the international coalition against ISIS, but I suspect there'll also be a request for the Qataris to be even more prominent in terms of their use of their own warplanes. They haven't been that much up front. It's been more of a nominal support for the coalition, you know, providing the base and having some logistical support they're providing. They do seem a little bit more likely to take a slightly more active role since the burning of the Jordanian pilot. They have reasonable relations with Jordan and reacted very badly to the immolation of the Jordanian pilot. So I think it will be probably, we'll get some kind of announcements from the White House that they've been very successful talks. The Qataris are going to be more involved. But whether we see the blocking of preachers from a jihadist basis being invited to the Grand Mosque, or if we see any more action on financial matters in terms of funding terrorist organizations or jihadist organizations, I'm skeptical.
Well, I'm glad you are. I think that's a realistic view. Let's talk about some folks, though, who have kind of gotten in the fight. When the Jordanian pilot was burned alive, Jordan really jumped it up. There was a lot of those great pictures of King Abdullah when he was jump mastering folks. They ran a bunch of airstrikes and really seemed disgusted enough to potentially take action. When the Christians, the Egyptian Coptic Christians, all 21 of them beheaded on the beach, Egypt seems to have jumped up and now is running some airstrikes. Can we actually expect any of these frenemy ally types to get in any meaningful way as partners in this fight?
Well, I mean, certainly the Egyptians are, I think, will continue the airstrikes and continue even a land raid as well. I believe the Special Operations Force went into parts of Derna as well. I think we can see that continuing. The Egyptian authorities, President Sisi, sees jihadists as a huge threat to him. And, of course, there are links between ISIS terror organizations in Egypt, as well as this expansion by Islamic State affiliate in Libya. One of the great problems with Libya, of course, is you've got the Qataris helping the so-called pro-Islamist government in Tripoli. You've got the Emirates and Egypt helping the internationally recognized government in Tobruk. No one really seems to have an overall plan of how to stabilize Libya, and they've all got political agendas which cut against each other. I mean, we saw recently, of course, the Italians, who are very nervous about what's happening. It's a short boat ride, Libya, from Italy. We're talking, the defense and foreign ministers, we're talking about Italy leading an international intervention in Libya. The Italians are not in any position to lead an international coalition. So, you know, the great danger really in Libya is that you have certain regional players who play on maybe the side we'd want them to play, but others are on the other side, and it's going to become an even bigger mess and a proxy war, which we are already, of course, seeing in Syria.
Well, we had a pretty interesting document. We discussed it earlier in the show, but President Obama sent a draft authorization for the use of military force against the Islamic State up to Congress, and it was remarkable in that he essentially was asking them to tie his hands, the military's hands, and the hands of his successor in many ways in this fight. Do you see any chance that the United States is going to actually provide some leadership, you know, get out from behind and do potentially? I mean, we'd have to help the Italians if they want to hit Libya, and we need to help in meaningful ways if anybody's going to take the Islamic State down and stop them from expanding.
I agree. In some ways, it ties the hands. In other ways, it has huge geographical reach. I think the whole problem, really, that we've seen in Syria, but also more broadly in the jihadist fight against both Al-Qaeda and against the Islamic State, has been a lack of coordination. No one seems to be in charge. No one seems to want to be in charge. You know, for years, the Obama administration really, against the advice of Leon Panetta and Hillary Clinton, one should note, really wanted to gain lead from behind in Syria and leave it to local players to play. But as I was pointing out, in Libya, then you get different agendas colliding. No one seems to be in charge. I think this is the great problem, a lack of coherence on policy. In many ways, I think that what the Western powers are doing, who don't really seem to have appetite for this fight, is to, I suppose, subcontract out to these regional players, and then we get into a bigger mess. The biggest, of course, are Iran, where we're supporting, really, in many ways, Iranian interests increasingly across the region. It's okay, they're supposed to have Shia militias fighting on the ground if you want a proxy force in Iraq, but the danger is that you rile up even more Sunni Muslims who feel that we're siding with the Shia. So, in other words, what I see is, it must be terrifying for your listeners, all these moving parts. The trouble is, it's a very complex region with a lot of moving parts, and you press, you know, in one area, use one moving part, and the other ones start going out of kilter. And what I see, and have been seeing for the last 3 years of roving the region, is this lack of coherence.
We'll see how it all plays out. Thanks for your insight and the work you're doing. Been talking with Jamie Detmer, who is a columnist for the Daily Beast, covers the Middle East, and also broadcast for Voice of America. Thanks, Jamie.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
We'll be back in just a minute with more Secure Freedom Radio, talking with Gordon Chang about the potential coming collapse of China. That could be interesting. This is Jim Hansen sitting in for Frank Gaffney.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. Something unusual occurred in the aftermath of President Obama's State of the Union address when Washington Post columnist Glenn Kessler cited research from the Center for Security Policy in his Fact Checker column to fault the truthfulness of the president's statements about his efforts to halt the threat from Iran's nuclear program. Kessler cited a chart prepared by the center showing that Iran's enrichment of uranium has surged since 2009, and that Iran can now make at least 8 nuclear weapons from its enriched uranium stockpile. It is unheard of for the mainstream media to cite conservatives on arms control issues. The Post's decision to cite the Center's research reflects both the high quality of our work as well as growing concerns about the president's Iran policy. You can read our report issued last November, Why Congress Must Repudiate the Nuclear Talks with Iran, on the SecureFreedom.org website. I'm Fred Fleitz.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm a firefighter.
A teacher.
I'm a farmer.
I'm a barber.
A waitress. A mom.
We're all part of your community. Every day we move in and out of each other's busy lives.
It's easy to take for granted all the little moments that make up our everyday.
Some are good,
others not so much.
But that's life. It's when you experience a moment of uncertainty, something or someone's behavior that doesn't seem quite right.
These are the moments to take a pause.
Because if something doesn't feel right, it's probably not.
It's not about paranoia
or being afraid.
It's about standing up and protecting our communities.
One detail at a time.
Because a lot of little details can become a pattern.
We
trust our instincts.
Just like you should.
Because only you know what's not supposed to be in your everyday.
So protect your everyday.
If you see something suspicious, say something to local authorities.
Great news for fans of Secure Freedom Radio. Now you can watch original Frank Gaffney and Center for Security Policy video content every day from the comfort of your living room. What makes this possible? A new video streaming service called Roku. All you need is a Roku player and a television to join the millions of Americans who customize their home viewing experience using the more than 1,000 Roku channels to access movies, TV shows, music, and more. When you add the cost-free Secure Freedom Roku channel, you'll gain unlimited streaming access to vital video products of the Center, including Secure Freedom Radio, Capitol Hill and National Press Club events, intelligence briefings, Frank Gaffney's acclaimed 10-part Muslim Brotherhood in America course, and more. The Secure Freedom Roku channel integrates information and entertainment, establishing a new media battle space in the war for the free world. Go to securefreedom.org/ROKU today to learn how you can be a part of it. We hope you'll see us soon.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Jim Hansen of the Center for Security Policy, sitting in for Frank Gaffney. We're talking now with Gordon Chang, who is a columnist for Forbes.com and also writes the World Affairs Journal, and who does a considerable amount of work keeping us all informed about the goings-on in the Pacific Rim. China being the major power, I think it's fair to say, in that
region has had an interesting course of affairs recently, and they've started to actually, whether they're cracking down or whether they're just paying more attention to some of the free trade going on in their own sphere of influence. But Alibaba, run by Jack Ma, a very interesting entrepreneur and an amazing individual, is now under investigation. Gordon, can you tell us a little bit about how that relationship is going and what actually is happening there?
Yeah. There are two government investigations of Alibaba Group, which is the e-commerce giant, one run by the State Administration for Industry and Commerce, and the other by the very powerful National Development and Reform Commission. And essentially, they're looking at all sorts of practices of Alibaba, but also practices of merchants who are on Alibaba's site. The important takeaway here is that there's a lot of counterfeit and substandard goods that are being sold on Alibaba's sites, and eventually Alibaba will have to take those merchants offline. And this is going to be important because it's going to result in a big hit to Alibaba revenue, and that means Alibaba's stock price is probably going to suffer. Alibaba is going to have to find new sources of revenue growth, and that is possible, but it's not going to be as easy as it once was in the past.
Well, now let me ask you, I can understand, obviously, you know, as a e-commerce giant, they're in the global marketplace, and it makes sense that they should not be furthering that. But correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't the Chinese government a pretty major pirate themselves as far as copyrighted goods and other things for a long time? Are they actually interested in making sure that an organization like Alibaba plays by the rules, or is there something else potentially at play here with their investigations?
Well, there are a number of things going on right now. Yes, it's true that Chinese government policy, not official, but certainly real policy, has been to prohibit the counterfeiting of goods of foreigners to help China get ahead. And this has gone on for decades, and it's still continuing today. But nonetheless, there are other pressures in Chinese society. So, for instance, individuals are concerned about knockoffs and counterfeit goods, and certainly foreign manufacturers and brand owners. So there's a lot of pressure on Alibaba, especially as Alibaba now has listed in the United States in the world's largest initial public offering last September. It has certainly much higher profile, and so it's getting a lot more scrutiny. And that's putting pressure on the Chinese government to do something. And Alibaba has been the target, and especially since last July when SAIC, State Administration for Industry and Commerce, actually had a long sit-down with Alibaba executives about some of the real problems on its sites. JD.com, which is also U.S. listed, has a different business model, and it is a competitor to Alibaba, and certainly it will benefit from Alibaba's problems because there appears to be much more control of the owners of JD.com on merchants who list on its sites. Also, JD has a direct sale model. They sell from their own inventory, which Alibaba does not do, and so therefore they do exert control. And I think they probably do a much better job on counterfeit and substandard goods.
Well, that'll be interesting to watch. Another potentially more dangerous problem is the fact that now China's been exerting influence in the entire region for a long time. They've, you know, been jockeying with their neighbors about sea lanes and jurisdiction and air exclusion zones and all those things, and basically kind of throwing their weight around. And recently, we've seen a fairly interesting pushback from the Japanese. I mean, the Japanese Constitution has pretty severe limits on what they can do. Their military is called the Self-Defense Force. And we've heard talk about potentially changing their constitution to allow offensive actions, whether it's against ISIS related to the tourists, but also in the way they can respond to pressures in the home region from China. What have you seen as far as naval and other actions from the Japanese?
Well, the Japanese are threatened by China, which claims Japanese territory as its own, specifically the Senkaku Islands in the East China Sea, which the Chinese have claimed since about 1971 and call them the Diaoyus. Because of that, Japan has had to defend itself, and therefore, you know, we have seen much more in the way of sentiment for Japan to do things which are effective, to help its allies, which it's now not permitted to do. It has what's known as Article 9 of the Peace Constitution, which disclaims the use of force. to settle international disputes, which means that Japan shouldn't have even a self-defense force. But it does. It is one of the most effective in Asia. And now the United States is looking to Japan to use its military means to preserve the peace, not only in the East China Sea, which surrounds Japan, but also in the South China Sea, which is far from Japanese shores. The United States, because it wants to see the Japanese become much more of a partner for peace, therefore is pushing the Japanese to do more to work with its defense partners, especially the United States.
And I guess China has been expanding all over. I mean, they've been buying mineral rights. They've been making alliances. They've really done a lot to become a superpower. I don't know if they reached that status yet, but they're certainly aiming for it, and it's their goal. Do we, as the United States, see the Japanese as a potential check on the expansions of the Chinese, whether it's, you know, in the region there or whether it's globally?
Well, certainly, because the United States has facing unprecedented challenges around the world, not only in Asia, but also elsewhere. And we're seeing, of course, you know, the Japanese, those two Japanese nationals who were executed by ISIS in those brutal beheadings. That has triggered, of course, concern in Japan about Japan exercising influence abroad, but it's also at the same time gotten support for Prime Minister Abe, who would like a more assertive Japanese state. And so at this point, there is going to be a lot of change and a lot of consideration and discussion in Japanese society about how far Japan should go in being this partner for peace around the world, not only in its own region, but also elsewhere, such as the Middle East. This is going to be one of the most fascinating national conversations anywhere, and the United States has a lot of stake in it because we do want the Japanese to help us.
And we don't have a lot of reliable allies who can project force anywhere. I mean, we have pretty much on our team the only expeditionary army, the really only true expeditionary navy. And like you said, Japan's military forces, self-defense or not, are potent. I mean, they work. They do. They know how to play the game. And having them as a partner could really give us not just a little leverage in the Pacific Rim, but if they're willing to join alliances and become part of coalitions of the willing, that could really change and give us someone who will help us in ways none of our older allies really have been.
Yeah, the Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Force is perhaps the most capable in Asia. If not, it's the second most capable behind China. It uses American equipment, and so therefore there's interoperability. And then this is going to be important because Japan occupies a very crucial piece of real estate in Asia. Without Japan, it would be very difficult for the United States to honor its treaty obligations to South Korea, for instance. And of course, we talk about Japan as our cornerstone ally in Asia. So this is going to be important how this conversation in Japan works out. We certainly want the Japanese to work more with us. And certainly as we see more and more countries on the periphery of China start to work more closely with the United States, Japan is going to be a key part in that, from what Japanese then Foreign Minister Taro Aso in 2006 called the Arc of Freedom and Prosperity. And that arc should go from India in the south to South Korea in the north, Japan being a crucial part of it.
Well, let's hope that continues. I will keep an eye on the region and look forward to hearing from you again. And that'll wrap up Secure Freedom Radio for this day. Keep your eyes peeled. Frank will be back with more truth and ideas in the war for the free world.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.